Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. Well, good morning, Justice Gordon Moore. How are you, my friend?
Good morning, Rich. You're great.
Good. It's good to see you, sir.
Nice to see you, and you need to give me a minute review of the Bob Dylan musical.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I did. I went to see on Saturday night. My wife and I went to see
Girl from the North Country.
Girl from the North Country, which you and your wife got to see earlier.
I saw last Thursday. Yep.
I liked it. I thought it was a challenging show. I was really glad that you and I had talked before I'd gone to see it because I knew it wasn't a story about Bob Dylan.
No.
But you had sort of warned me that this was a kind of a dark show.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, I read more about it afterwards than before.
Yeah.
And the show was reviewed. It got rave reviews in London. West End, when it opened, Brits really related to it. And some compared it to like Our Town.
Yep.
A little bit of the fourth wall being broken with the narrator talking about the events in this boarding house in Duluth in 1934. Mm-hmm. And this is not a Bob Dylan jukebox musical.
No.
It's not a story about Bob Dylan's life at all.
Under no circumstances.
It is using really kind of, I'd say, a back catalog of Dylan material. It's not even his greatest hits.
You've got like a Rolling Stone in there, but you're right. I mean, a lot of fairly obscure Dylan music in there. And the music they used was arranged differently. I mean, it was not. If you wanted to go have a nice night listening to people sing some Dylan songs and tell you a story about a boy from the Iron Range who went to the big city and became the voice of a generation, you were sorely disappointed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't that at all. The music was used in a way to, I think, accentuate some of what was going on in the stage, and you could really feel the. Thursday night, we have the benefit of the closed captioning event
And
so you could see the lyrics, and it really, to Jane and I think it brought out a lot of the depth of Dylan's music in a way that sometimes Dylan's voice can be tough for some people to get around.
It can.
And, you know, it is true that his voice over the years has evolved, but this show is worth seeing. We had a bit of a mixed review in our household, frankly. I think I liked it probably a little more than Jane did, but that was maybe as influenced by my general love for Dylan's music. But it's probably worth multiple seeing visits, actually, as I reflect on it.
My wife and I are both really big Bob Dylan fans. As a matter of fact, we saw Bob Dylan on our wedding night. At the Orpheum Theater, as a matter of fact. She liked it more than I did. I thought it was fascinating. I didn't always think the music worked with the story, and I really think I could have benefited also from the closed captioning thing. But on our way home, Annie was doing some research. They're making it into a movie with Olivia Colman and Woody Harrelson.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Which will be very interesting indeed. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not a ton of likable characters in this show. It's really dark.
Yep.
And, you know, the like a Rolling Stone, I mean, these people are all just kind of directionless. They're down and outers. This is the Depression.
Yep.
They've all been affected by things in life differently, and they all assemble in this rundown boarding house in Duluth in the heart of the Depression, and it's dark. I mean, it is dark thematically. It's dark. It's a dark set. The lighting is dark. I mean, it's not a musical for the faint of heart. There's some tough stuff talked about and, frankly, implied.
Right.
That's really, you know, concerning.
If you're a hardcore Bob Dylan fan and you know what it is going in, you would probably like this movie very much. If you are just in general a fan of theater and what theater can be, I think you would also like this movie very much. But if you're you're a casual fan who wanted to go see a Bob Dylan story, it's not for you.
No, it's not. But
anyway.
Yeah, interesting. The governor was there, I think, on opening night, touting the show. The run kicks off in Minneapolis at the Orpheum Theater, which I'm told that Bob Dylan
used to
own.
Yeah.
So it's appropriate from that standpoint. And national tour starting. The singing and performances are outstanding.
Yeah, they are. The cast is great.
Top notch. Yeah. It's the book in the storyline that gets a little murky. But, you know, Dylan's music is nothing if not ambiguous. And that, boy, does that come out. I mean, this playwright, I think he was an Irish playwright that did this. This was not done in collaboration with Dylan all.
Nope.
Although I'm told that Dylan was profoundly affected by it, liked it a lot.
I read that he sort of went, no one got him tickets. He bought his own ticket. He went incognito. People were sitting next to Bob Dylan in the theater and didn't realize it was Dylan. And he said he was crying at the end of the show. So,
So, well, interesting. I suppose we should talk about the law.
I suppose.
just for thematic purposes here.
It is the birthday of both Oscar Wilde and Eugene O'Neill. So we keep talking about depressing plays. I mean, that would be
a lot of interesting literature with those
no
two
questions.
Figures.
So Justice Moore, how's everything in St. Paul?
It's going well. We had our big transition at the start of October with Chief Justice Hudson taking over from Chief Justice Lori Gilday. And that's very sudden. I mean, just one day, you know, Chief Justice Gilday's gone after 13 years.
Right.
I mean, it's a clean break. They don't give you weeks to sort of wind things down. You are done one day.
Is there any pomp and circumstance? Is there a swearing in ceremony or is anything like that?
There will be a public investiture, I believe, coming up before Thanksgiving for both Chief Justice Hudson and our new Associate Justice colleague, Carl Procaccini. They were both sworn in before the start of the term privately with just family members present before the court session started, I think, on October 2nd, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, 2 weeks ago. So they've been on the job for 2 weeks, both of them. I mean, obviously, Justice Hudson had been a member of our court for many years. But, and we got thrown right into it, or our new colleague got thrown right into oral arguments immediately.
Right.
And then we went out to Montevideo High School last Tuesday and Wednesday for the traveling oral argument to the 8th District, which was very good.
Before I let you get too far down that road, I want to ask you. I mean, as a colleague, any thoughts on Justice Gilday's career?
Well, it's going to be marked by the things that she did to bring us, first of all, into the technological era with eCourt and the Minnesota Court Records Online. Prior to 2014, 2013, it was really hard to find things. You had to go to a courthouse and ask for a file. You had to know what case you were talking about. And now, due to the work that's been done by the branch on this program called MCRO, Minnesota Court Records Online, you have what we sometimes derisively refer to as pajama access. I mean, you can sit
you
on the couch and you know, whether that's good or bad, I think maybe is in the eye of the beholder a little bit. But as far as transparency and openness, people have the ability to do a lot of research online that they never used to be able to do.
As a journalist, I've used it myself, and I greatly appreciate the service.
Yes, the journalists do, the historians do, parties do, lawyers do. They're able to find out information about cases. I mean, a prospective client comes in and tells you something. From my experience as a lawyer, you need to verify that. Mm-hmm. You need to actually do your own research and figure out what's happening in this case. And that is available now. And Chief Justice Gilday was the head of that initiative. The other real, I'd say, you know, guidepost or signpost for her regime was the COVID pandemic and getting us through three years of the COVID pandemic, with keeping the doors of justice open, keeping courthouses open, keeping things going despite having to work remotely oftentimes, using remote tools such as Zoom and WebEx for court hearings.
Yep.
We're never going to be the same as a result of that. And she led this court system through that. We will miss her for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, congratulations to Justice Gilday on a just a remarkable career.
Yeah. And she is the first to say that she is not done. I fully expect to see her in some legal capacity. She's too young to retire, frankly.
Yeah.
And
I think she's
just, you know, was looking for a different change of pace, and she's getting it. But so we have our new colleague, and so the court's trying to sort that out. We have internal chambers moves that occur when a new member of the court comes.
You are no longer the new kid on the court.
I'm not.
Does that mean you get to move out of the new kid's office and into something a little more fancy?
Eventually, the offices hate to break the news, the offices are all the same, except for the chief's chambers. The chief's chambers are a little different, but the associate justice chambers are all the same. But yeah, I will probably move after Justice Anderson retires. Mm-hmm. We're trying to not create total chaos.
Right.
Two moves in a term for a lot of people is too much.
Right.
So I think I will. I personally, and Justice Thiessen, will be moving after Justice Anderson retires later mm-hmm. in 2024. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the new kid office will go to Justice Procaccini. He's doing very well. He's a quick study, right on board and jumping into things. And so yeah, we did go out to Montevideo. That
yeah.
We didn't, when we scheduled that, we had no idea that we're going to have this transition, obviously.
Right.
Montevideo High School hosted the court. Actually, the Montevideo School District held a dinner for the kind of a meet your court event for the community at the Armory in Montevideo, which is attached to the high school. And Montevideo generously invited three or four other school districts. I believe McRae, Dawson, Boyd, Yellow Medicine high schools were all invited to the Montevideo High School for the oral argument.
Montevideo is sort of in the middle of the state, isn't it?
It's more on the west side of the state. It's about 2.5 hours west of here on Highway 212, Highway 7. And boy, it was the heart of soybean harvesting and sugar beet harvesting before that rain came. It was all hands on deck in the fields. The beautiful weather. We had a really good reception. The people in Montevideo were great to work with.
When were you out there?
We went out last Tuesday afternoon. The arguments were Wednesday, so it was pre-rain.
Okay.
And yeah, we argued State versus Trifoletti before the students, a case involving COVID-related issues with testimony, which mm-hmm. I think was something that everybody could sort of relate to. We didn't obviously decide the case in front of them. That will happen in the normal course. But we did argue it, and then two of the justices went into classrooms. Me and two other members of the court went and did tours of local courthouses to talk to court staff. So
fantastic.
Yeah, it was great. It's one of the best things that we do. Followed up by later this month, our swearing-in ceremony for the new lawyers of the state that passed the bar. That happens in later October, and that's just a fantastic day for families to come to the House of Representative chambers and get sworn in to be a lawyer.
That's really neat. I didn't realize that was I guess I didn't realize that was a thing. I thought you passed the bar and that was that. You just started practicing after that.
It's a big thing, Rich. It used to be a little less of one, frankly. I think when I got sworn in, I remember going to one of the O'Shaughnessy auditoriums. It was either St. Thomas or St. Kate's, and it was a mass cattle call ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a bit of an institutional feel.
Sure.
The court used to use Roy Wilkins Auditorium for that, too.
Yeah.
Thanks to Justice G. Barry Anderson, we decided that we needed to bring this ceremony back to the Capitol.
Nice.
And that happened a couple of years ago, and it's been very well received.
That's fantastic.
Now, what that does require of the court are five or six similar ceremonies, one after another on the hour, because we just don't have enough room for everybody to come in.
Right.
So the poor justice that has to give the speech has to do it over and over and endure the ridicule of his or her colleagues for, the speech. And boy, I'll tell you, I did that a couple of years ago, and that was painful.
That's funny.
One of the really nice parts of this event is that family members can move for the admission of other family members, so son, daughter, niece, nephew, et cetera. And it's surprisingly emotional to see that generational passing of the torch. Jane and I have friends from Worthington who are going to be up with their son. The judge out in Yellow Medicine County is going to be there with his son. I just learned that last week. I mean, it's kind of one of those good feeling days for the court, which nobody's unhappy with something. Everybody's happy with that result. So
full of hope and optimism.
That's the last Friday of October, and we do a special swearing in ceremony for our Supreme Court law clerks the week before that, and then they get to help us out with the marshaling of that event. So yeah, it's good, and it's fun for our law clerks. We do it in the Capitol courtroom, and family members get to come in and see that, and there's pictures taken and lots of pomp and circumstance, which is fun.
You guys have a lot going on having nothing to do with hearing oral arguments.
Well, there is a lot that's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the work of the court is this sort of outreach mm-hmm. that has to be done to right. the bar, the bench bar, and the community. And that's what the Traveling Earl argument is all about.
Which is so interesting because of the three branches of government, you don't think of the Supreme Court as, I mean, the Supreme Court, you guys are sort of cloaked in dignity and for, you know, for lack of a better, you know, cloak, but you don't think of the Supreme Court being an outgoing type of entity. And that's just not true. I mean, you guys understand, or someone with the Supreme Court has understood the need for outreach like this. And so you guys have embraced that.
Well, the trust and confidence of the people is necessary for the system to work. And Chief Justice Sandy Keith started this Traveling Oral Argument Program in 1994 or 5
wow.
when he was on the court. I think we've done 54 of these now
wow.
all around the state. We do one outstate oral argument in the fall, one metro area, one in the spring. And it is, yes, it is an effort to bring the court to the people
yeah.
for at least a morning. I mean, you know, most of the time we are in St. Paul, kind of in our chambers and in the courtrooms up there. And, you know, your average citizen really, other than the live stream, which we encourage people to watch, mm-hmm. actually watching an oral argument in person doesn't happen very frequently. But this gives people an opportunity to do that. And it's a lot of fun. It's just it's an engaging, it's a reaffirming process. It reminds us all of why we're doing what we're doing.
I cannot imagine a better educational experience for these kids than having the Supreme Court come to their school auditorium, hear an actual oral argument, and then for a couple of the justices to go and visit classrooms.
What we're trying to do, Rich, is get young people interested in legal issues, mm-hmm. the law. We have a lot of lawyers that are retiring over the next, you know, few years. Baby boom starts to edge out of the legal world, and we need lawyers. We need people committed to justice, and so we are encouraging people to consider it.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people. I didn't come from a family of lawyers. Some do. Some have multiple generations, but I came from a family. Well, my uncle was a lawyer in Michigan, but I really didn't know much about what a right. lawyer actually did.
Right.
And so this is a glimpse to that. And we're hoping to trigger interest in the community in legal issues and in the importance of legal issues. And there are so many of them. But just young people, civics, knowledge of, you know, how the three branches of government interact. I'm really worried that, you know, civics education, history have fallen by the wayside.
Indeed.
Unfortunately, you know, the number of, I mean, you know, my alma mater, Carleton here, computer science is by far the number one
yep.
most popular major.
Yep.
And that, I don't think, was a thing in 1985 when I graduated.
Nope.
If it was, it was a minor or like a part of another thing. And now it's huge. And for obvious reasons, I mean, computers, you know, are critical for our society, but knowledge of our history, knowledge of what's happening, if there couldn't be a more relevant time for that.
My goodness.
I mean, you're thinking of everything happening
right.
in Washington right now.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, we'll talk just in a moment about Justice Barrett coming today
yep,
to the U
yep.
of M. I mean, there are so many things happening where some knowledge and some understanding is important to really get an appreciation for it.
I'm not that much younger than you are. And when you, in 85, when you graduated from Carleton, I was in high school and I was thinking about possibly a career in law and was talked out of it by a lot of people because I was told over and over again, this was the middle 1980s, that there were more people in law school at that point than there were lawyers on the planet. That's not the case anymore, is it?
It's not. I mean, I remember that era, too, where, yeah. you know, getting jobs was not a guarantee. Getting mm-hmm. into law school was not a guarantee,
right.
frankly. And things have changed quite a bit in that time period. And, yes, the baby boom generation retiring has opened up a lot of opportunities,
yeah.
And
yeah.
particularly in outstate areas. If you really are interested in making a huge impact in your community, becoming a judge, becoming a legislator, becoming, you know, a partner in a law law firm, small town legal practice gives you that immediate opportunity. Now, big law can as well,
right?
And so can the big prosecutor and public defender's office in the cities. But mm-hmm. boy, there's a lot of good law being practiced outside of the mosquito control district, as we call it. And so we're trying to encourage people from places like Montevideo to consider a career that maybe they wouldn't necessarily see every day in terms of, you know, the type of work that they'd be interested in doing.
Well, but, boy, maybe there's hope for me yet. Maybe I should, my
second career, Rich.
My law career, my law dreams don't have to die. Yeah,
they don't. You know, there are flexible learning opportunities out there. Right.
Indeed,
now.
Indeed. So, what have you guys been doing? Well, so I should say this. What are you guys looking for, or what is coming down the
November the is going to be an important month. We have 12 cases. We have 4 first degree murder direct appeals.
Wow.
4 of them in 1 month. That's a lot. 1 first-degree murder post-conviction case. Those also directly come to our court. That's where a person isn't directly appealing their conviction, but they have a post-conviction relief petition pending seeking some relief from a former first-degree murder conviction. We do have 5 petitions for review of Court of Appeals civil and criminal decisions in different areas, 1 appeal from the Workers' Compensation Court, and then probably the most important and impactful case on our docket in November is on November 2nd, mm-hmm. Groh versus Simon. That is the challenge to the question of whether former President Trump can be a candidate on the ballot under the Constitution. And so we have granted amicus or friend of the court status to 7 different organizations or people. We are going to be getting a lot of input from very fine lawyers on that case, and we will be considering only that case that day. That's how important it is. Usually we do 2. Yeah. We're only doing 1. And I would really encourage citizens to log into the live stream that morning, watch for themselves, and listen to what I assume is just going to be some excellent legal advocacy.
I'm not going to ask you a single question about that case because I know you really can't talk about it other than what you said. Mm-hmm. That's all I want to talk to you about, but of course you can't say a word about it.
Nope, I can't.
Yeah, I just want to echo though that idea that people should be logging on that day and watch the live stream. This is one of 3, I believe, cases being brought in states across the country. It's been argued in Colorado, somewhere out east too, I believe. This is going to be a major, major topic of conversation down the line. And I think it's safe to assume that the court will hear the arguments. And I'm not going to ask you to comment at all on this. It's just sort of safe to assume that you will sort of expedite your decision a little bit.
Yes.
You will most likely not be the last word on the situation.
Well, my understanding is the Colorado case was actually filed in the trial court. This is a case filed under the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. So from an appeal standpoint, it is possible that Minnesota's could be the closest case to the United States Supreme Court.
Okay.
So, we will issue an order. We always say in due course,
mm-hmm.
but because of deadlines for ballot preparation and other things, we know when this order needs to get done. So this is going to be an all hands on deck
yep.
thing. And I probably the less said the better, other than I would just encourage people to... There's a lot of information about the theories behind it that's out there on the internet, mm-hmm. and probably more than people have time to research. But watching the arguments, I think, will be very instructive.
Okay. Have you? Are there any decisions yet from the previous session that have yet to be rendered?
Yeah, we do. We've got a few of them.
Okay.
They're always the toughest. They're the hardest.
How does that work now with the changeover from the court? Do you does Justice Gilday still participate in those decisions?
She participated in the conference, and unless her vote was considered to be dispositive, any case where her vote was going to define what the court did was issued before she left.
Okay.
So, yes, she did participate. Our new person did not.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we do have a handful of what we call holdover cases. Mm-hmm. And trust me, those are tough. They're usually the hard lifts.
Right.
We've got probably 5 or 6 of them, and they are impactful. They'll be, hopefully in the next few weeks, we'll be getting those out. But there's, as you might sense, there's a lot going on with the court right
now. No question. And today you have a rather busy day, and we're going to get you out of here in just a couple of minutes because you are going to be up at the University of Minnesota today.
Yes. Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett is appearing at the Robert Stein Lecture at the University of Minnesota at Northrop Auditorium later this afternoon, basically for a moderated conversation with former law school dean Robert Stein. And the Stein Lectures or the Stein Series, he's invited a number of Supreme Court justices across the ideological spectrum.
Sure.
This one is obviously getting some play in the media. There's no question about that. But the court members of the court were invited, and I felt like it was important to be there.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it just out of respect for the position, out of comedy, and frankly, out of educational to learn to, to try to understand.
100%.
And so that's what's going on. And I don't know if the U is going to live stream this. I don't know if that's an option. I'm sure the media will cover it.
Oh yeah.
It'll be something that will be talked about. And yeah, I'm really interested in hearing what Justice Coney Barrett has to say. One of my former law clerks 3 years ago was at Notre Dame when Justice Barrett was elevated to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot going on. A couple of things notable about Justice Barrett. One is that she doesn't come from a law school that is an Ivy League school. I mean, just she's, that's not her background. I mean, it's a totally different background from most of the members of the court. And she has a family with a lot of children. She has many children.
Okay.
5, 7 children.
Wow.
And so she and her husband have been our parents in addition to being on the court.
Mm-hmm.
How she balances all that, I'm sure we may hear about that today. I can't imagine.
It just occurs to me that being a Supreme Court justice is far more than a full-time job.
Yes.
And so that's a heck of a thing to have to balance out.
So yeah, we'll listen to Justice Barrett this afternoon and could report back in November.
I will be fascinated. I will tell you, I'm jealous. I wish I was able to go and listen to her speak. Even though I'd probably understand about a third of what, because this is a law lecture or a law moderated conversation.
It is. So. Yeah, Dean Stein was dean of the law school at the U of M for many years.
Right.
Very respected legal scholar. And I think from my standpoint, the key question that I'm going to be listening for is, is he going to go into any of the tough conversations that could be had that I think some have suggested ought to be had? And so, the purpose for this moderated discussion ought to be engaging. And so I hope Dean Stein does engage, I don't think it's intended to be firing line, in terms of the type of questions. But, there are some topics that I'm sure people are interested in hearing her perspective on. How much she can say is another issue.
I mean, it's
kind of like me. You're limited on what you can or should say.
Exactly.
You may have things you'd like to say, but you shouldn't say. And so, stay tuned on that, Rich. But we'll talk about that in November when I come back. And I'd also like to talk in November. The Supreme Court added a second case to its docket involving the so-called Chevron doctrine, administrative doctrine.
Yes.
So I'd like to talk about that next time because that is for blockbuster cases of this SCOTUS term coming up. That might be it, frankly, in terms of, attacks on precedent that have, I mean, we don't have Dobbs. We don't have, freedom of speech cases term, but we've got this Chevron case involving the fundamental questions of how much the court should defer to administrative agencies in the so-called administrative state. And so this is got big implications.
I'm going to really look forward to that conversation. And folks, as listeners, I'm going to refer you back a couple of weeks, Public Policy This Week, which you can find on KYMNradio.net. 2 weeks ago, we had President Emeritus of Carleton College, Steve Poskanzer, on talking with Professor Alan Rosenstein of the University of Minnesota Law School. And they go through the Supreme Court docket for every session, and they spend a lot of time talking about Chevron. And I'm going to go back and listen to that again before you come on. There's a lot there for a decision that a lot of people don't really know much about. It is a very, very, very interesting decision that the Supreme Court is going to have to rule on.
Yeah, it absolutely is, Rich. And I think what is driving a lot of the interest is the concern about the future of the doctrine. It's been around since 1984. How it gets applied, the court is kind of ducked dealing with it, but not now. The question is presented foursquare: should this be overruled or modified? And it has a lot of effects on all sorts of federal regulations involving everything. The cases where the review has been granted involve fishery regulations mm-hmm. from the East Coast, but you know, clean air, water, I mean, you know, health and safety, vaccines. I mean, it goes on and on.
Yeah.
Every, you know, the administrative state, as they say, is part of all of our lives.
Right.
And how much deference should courts give to administrative agencies in interpreting legal authorization that Congress gives them to run their agency?
Right.
You know, basically who's in charge.
Right. Them. Yeah. And if the court, as I understand it, if the court sort of disallows this decision, Congress then becomes responsible for making a lot more administrative decisions, which, you know, I'm just going to editorialize here a little bit. Looking at the disarray in Congress right now, I'm not sure we want to throw that kind of responsibility on them.
Well, the concern, Rich, you know, not to get too far off topic here,
yeah.
but the political aspects of these decisions too. If every decision is being looked at through a political lens as
yep.
opposed to a public policy lens, where does that drive us?
Yeah.
You know, if we're talking about things like, you know, clean air legislation or groundwater legislation, if that's all viewed from a political lens as opposed to a scientific lens, is that good for the polity? I mean, that's really kind of what we're talking about. So I've got to be a little careful here mm-hmm. because, you know, the state Supreme Court deals with administrative agencies at the state level, and we are subject to some of the same discussions about, you know, how much deference do we give state agencies that have expertise in subject matter in terms of, you know, implementing their law. On the other hand, who fundamentally has the responsibility to say what the law is? I mean, mm-hmm. that's the Supreme Court, not administrative agencies.
Right.
And so that's the tension. And,
yeah.
you know, stay tuned on this one. This is going to be, these cases are going to be argued in January. So this will be one of those end of June blockbuster
sure.
cases that yeah. will come out at the end of the term. But yeah, we can talk more
yeah.
about it in November.
We'll probably, you and I will probably talk about it two or three more times.
I would guess so,
yeah.
Rich.
Okay. Justice Gordon Moore. I always enjoy legal talk, sir. Thank you so much.
Thanks
for
having me in, Rich.
Yep.
I appreciate the listeners.
And we will see everybody again in the third Monday of November for Legal Talk. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.